Welcome to our Goals to Podcasts, where we take you behind the scenes with authors of many different writing styles. I'm Lucinda Hawksley, and today we're looking at the art of novel writing. I hope you enjoy this episode. If you want to find out more, go to www.goldster.co.uk and don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Goldster Conversation. I'm thrilled today to welcome Ruth Lee, who is the author of this great book, if you can see it, A Great Deal of Ingenuity. And these are new stories inspired by Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. Now, I know we have quite a lot of Jane Austen fans at Goldster. So, Ruth, welcome to Goldster. It's lovely to have you here.
Lovely to be here.
Can you tell me, when did your love of Jane Austen begin? Can you remember?
Yes, I can imagine. I can remember it almost exactly to the moment. We did it for our English literature O-level when I was 14, and it completely went over my head. I was like, what is this all about? Put it on my bookshelf.
Which book was that?
Pride and Prejudice. We did Pride and Prejudice, didn't get it at all. I was 14. The next year, I turned 15, and it was up on my bookshelf at home. And I took it down and thought, I'll just have a look. And I can still remember sitting on my little single bed in my single bedroom. This would have been in the early 80s, thinking, oh my goodness, this is incredible. So I have been reading it and loving it since I was 15 years old.
What do you think it was changed in that one year in you that made you appreciate it?
That's a great question. I think teaching children myself, as I do quite often now, I think the years between year 8 and year 9, the teenage brain matures to such an extent. You read more, you see more, you understand more. And I think I was ready for it. I read very widely anyway. And I think I was just ready for that slightly more sophisticated narration and that more sophisticated plot. And I think the fact that it was five girls, many of whom were teenagers, really spoke to me. And then, of course, I started reading all the other novels as well.
Yeah, that's so interesting, because actually, when I look back at my teenage years, I was the most extraordinary reader. I read widely, fascinatingly, incredibly tough stuff. Then now I might go, oh, that looks like a bit hard work. Yeah. I wish I still had that mojo that I had, that reading mojo as a teenager. It's an interesting thought that our brains are just so ready to absorb the most extraordinary new things. Perhaps I need to get that back again.
Oh, can we get it back? Is that even possible?
I don't know.
Find out.
So, A Great Deal of Ingenuity. I really enjoyed this book. Can you tell everybody what it's about and what your premise was for writing this?
Yes, of course. Again, I can remember exactly when the idea came to me very early on in lockdown. I was sitting up in bed rereading it for the umpteenth time when suddenly it occurred to me that about 25 years before the action starts, there must have been a pretty merry teenage girl living in a Hertfordshire town called Miss Gardner looking for a husband. I thought, oh, hello, I know who Miss Gardner is, but a lot of people won't. So I wrote Miss Gardner's story through the eyes of her brand new husband, who is passionately in love with her and can't wait to start this amazing married life. But of course, under her married name, she is much better known in the novel. I won't say who she is in case it spoils it. So that started me off. And I thought, oh, actually, hang on a minute. There are all these women in this novel who walk through scenes, who are in scenes, who are catalysts, but they don't, either they say one thing or they have nothing to say, because, you know, as a novelist, you can't put words in the mouth of every single character. So I started looking into it and I found all these people, like the Colonel's wife, Mrs. Forster. All we know about her is that she's a very young woman lately married and an intimate friend of Lydia Bennet. But why? Why is a teenager married a man in his probably 40s? So we got her story, Mrs. Annesley, the companion, Sally, the maid, who has to mend the slit in Lydia's worked muslin gown after she's eloped. So I wrote about four of them and I loved it. And then this being lockdown, my life changed. I got a book deal for my contemporary humour novels and I shelved it. And then I came back to it and I went through the novel again and found more strong women who needed their own stories telling. So it is nine short stories around minor characters in the novel.
It's such a great idea. And when I started reading them, I realised how well I knew Pride and Prejudice, which I hadn't actually realised, because my absolute fave is Persuasion.
Oh,
and
yes.
That's what I could probably do a similar thing, because I feel I know those characters intimately. When you were writing it, did you find that there were so many more that you wanted to get in? Did you have to stop at a certain point?
Actually, no. Again, that's a great question. No one's ever asked me this. No, it was exactly the right number. I found my nine and there it was, done. And my plan was to carry on throughout the novels and do exactly the same. So I found my nine in Emma and I will keep going. And for some novels, I think it's easier than others. But I think someone once said that Pride and Prejudice, you know, is plotted like a Swiss clock. You know, everything, every cog, every little wheel is there for a reason. So those nine were just so easy to find. I don't think there's really anybody left unless I start really delving into the Lucas family tree, which I could.
Ooh, you absolutely could, yes. And so did you find yourself writing a family tree for all of them and working it out and coming up with extra things that you'd not thought about before in your previous readings?
Yes, I suppose I did. What I didn't want to do, and many people do this, and hats off to them, but it's not me. What I didn't want to do was change the novel in any way. Nothing changes in my book. You know, everything that happens, happens as it does. But what I wanted to do almost was shine a light. So I thought, okay, I did think about the Lucases. I thought, here we have Charlotte, who is one of a numerous family. So plenty of brothers and sisters, but we only really know about Mariah. So I gave names to some of the other daughters and thought, well, actually, with Charlotte safely married in Hunsford, she now has the power to chaperone her sisters and perhaps bring them down to Hunsford to find them husbands. Yeah. So that happens in a story narrated by somebody else. We see that going on in the background. And that story pops up a few times in different stories. So yes, I did think about family trees. I did think about the interconnected world of Meryton too, where everyone knows everyone and in many cases has always known everyone, which gives an interesting slant to it.
And it's that society that Jane Austen built,
right,
which is so recognisable even today in more communities. When you were going through her characters, did you start thinking about the way that human nature changes or doesn't change? Did you start thinking about parallels with today?
Very much so. And I would say that human nature doesn't change. It is immutable and unchanging. Certainly our society changes in some ways, but really, It's the endless verities, isn't it? You know, you've got people trying to advance themselves. You've got some people who are nice, some people who are not so nice, people who betray you, those who are just solid family folk who just trundle along. You know, you've got romance, you've got love, you've got hate, you've got misunderstanding. It's all still there. And I don't think that her novels will be read as widely as they are today. Still, if that wasn't the case, you know, if you think of how many great novelists and poets there are from the 18th and 19th century who were huge in their time, Walter Scott, Arthur Clough, people like that, who reads them now? Nobody. Yeah. And there has to be a reason for that.
Yeah. And I agree with you about human nature. I mean, writing biography, you realize that human nature doesn't change. We could go back to the 1200s and meet people who we absolutely understood and got on with. As you say, it's just living under a different society's rules that makes us think they're different. I mean, I perpetually find people think that all Victorian women were really weak and pathetic. And it's so infuriating.
No, they weren't.
So I'm assuming that Pride and Prejudice is your favourite Austen novel. Am I right in that?
Well, absolutely right in that.
So tell people who may not have read Pride and Prejudice, because it's going to be one that we do for the Goldster Book of the Month at some point next year. Tell people what it is about, or give them a quick idea of the novel and what it is that you love about it.
Okay, so in a nutshell, it's set in a small country town in Hertfordshire, probably in the late 18th century, so about 1796, something like that. And it centres on the main family of Bennets, and they are a married couple with five daughters aged between 15 and 22. Now, they're not well off, but they're comfortable. So Mr. Bennet has a small house and estate. They are respectable people, and respectability is what it's all about. And they intersect with lots of other families in Meryton, the neighbouring village. And what the story appears to be about is lots of mothers trying to get get husbands for their daughters. And that's certainly what drives the plot. Mrs. Bennet is desperate to get her daughters married. However, she has to be, because economically she's married a man who isn't great with money. And unless she has a son, the whole estate, when Mr. Bennet dies, will pass sideways to their cousin. So you've got this massive drive straight away of a woman who's desperate to find nice young men to marry her daughters. You have other ladies in the village doing the same thing. And then you have the young ladies themselves. So the family is basically split in two. You have the two elder daughters who are beautiful and clever and intellectual and sensible. You have the middle daughter who is plain and unattractive and a bit of a middle child. And you have the two younger daughters who are your typical hormone-fueled, giddy sort of girls. Then you've got lots of other families in the village all intersecting. And then every so often, somebody new comes in and changes everything. So you have a lot of balls, and that is a way that people can meet. So basically, the daughters find men, everything goes wrong, but it's okay in the end. Some people get married happily, some people not so much. Some people change, some people don't. That's a very large nutshell.
And I think you should be teaching Jane Austen to every child in this country because that was wonderful.
Thank you.
So I think my personal theory is that Mrs. Bennet gets a bad rap in modern day. I mean, she's doing her best to ensure her daughter's future. And she's always seen as a kind of figure of fun.
Sure.
Do you have any personal feelings about Mrs. Bennet?
Do you know I do? And these feelings have been coming on for some time, to quote the novel. I just don't like the way that she's always the silly, giggly fool who's desperately trying to run after men to get her daughters married off. And Mr. Bennet is seen as this jolly old curmudgeon who spends half his time in the library. Actually, and I really dig into this in the book, actually, Mr. Bennet is completely abdicating his responsibilities as a father and husband.
Yeah.
Mrs. Bennet, okay, she's not perhaps the brightest spark, but then, you know, she's married, she's got these children, she's doing her very best. And I think actually a lot of modern retellings do her a great disservice. That's why I wanted to make her, wanted to put her in the book. She said, whoops, spoiler there, it almost fell out.
No, it's fine. So we've got a comment here saying she's actually quite manipulative, which yes, I do agree with that, Pauline, but I think she kind of has to be. Yeah, and I'm getting a nod from Pauline there. We've got a comment here from Geeta. Love your summary. Obviously, you're a great storyteller.
Oh, and I've got a private letter saying,
please, can we have Pride and Prejudice on the Goldster Book of the Month? So,
yes, do it. Please do it.
Coming up in the new year, we shall do that. Thank you. So you've mentioned Emma. So you're giving Emma the same treatment as you've just given Pride and Prejudice.
Yes. And I've gone as far as what I always do. Obviously, I reread the novel and I read everything around it. So you'll see at the back of A Great Deal of Ingenuity, there's quite a long bibliography. You know, I read all the scholarly works. I read a few of the retellings. You know, you have to do that to get into the world, to inhabit it, because the world of Emma is very different to the world of Pride and Prejudice. You know, it's later, it's quite different. It's got a rich heroine, her only one. Oh. So I've got my nine characters chosen, and that being a later one will abut much more onto Victorian times, which is my specialist subject from university. So that will happen. However, I always listen to my readers and I always read my reviews. Ingenuity came out and I shared, you know, with a few people and on social media that I'd be doing Emma next. And lots of people said, no, please don't do that just yet. What I'd like you to do is take some of our favourite characters from Ingenuity and expand their stories. So that's what I'm going to do. Another book after this one. I don't know what it's going to be called, but four characters will be...
You're already in A Great Deal of Ingenuity and you're going to expand on their stories. Fantastic. Well, isn't that great that that's come from your readers?
Yeah, I was delighted. I always listen to my readers. They come up with brilliant ideas.
Excellent. Oh, that's so good. And it's obviously really spoken to people.
It does seem to have done. People have really taken it on board. A lot of chaps have taken it on board. I'm very happy when I get man readers.
Right.
I do have lots of them. And they all, almost without exception, their favourite one is The Cook's Tale, which, if you recall, is Mrs. Nichols from Netherfield, who is... a very angry and enraged, very successful blackmailer. Bit of a psychopath, but you know, you can see where it comes from. And the chaps all love that one.
You must have had so much fun writing this.
I did. Honestly, researching herbal medicines in Hertfordshire in the 18th century, my search box, the people, if they'd come in, would have thought I had lost my mind. What is this lunatic woman doing? Lamb's ears, you know, canker, running sores. Oh, such fun.
So do you have certain characters in Pride and Prejudice about whom you feel protective?
Yes, absolutely, I do. Mm-hmm. Mrs. Bennet and Charlotte, actually. Charlotte Lucas. I think Charlotte, and again, this is something that's been mentioned in scholarly works, Austen didn't have enough time, I don't think, in the novel. There wasn't space to develop Charlotte, who I think is one of the most interesting female characters in a novel ever. We know relatively little about her, but if you dig in and actually shine a light on what she does and what she says and how she conducts herself, especially around the Bennets, because all her life, I think, she's probably had to put up with sort of little snippy remarks about her looks, because don't forget, Lady Lucas and Mrs. Bennet are in competition. They both have daughters. Gotcha. So Charlotte, I feel protective of. Who else? I suppose I must have had some feelings of that towards Mrs. Jenkinson and Mrs. Annesley, who were the two companions or governesses in the novel. Because I felt that they must be middle-aged or elderly women who were respectable, who were middle class, but who had fallen on difficult times, you know, for no fault of their own, and were forced to work. And can you imagine having Lady Catherine de Bourgh as your boss?
Oh my goodness, no, absolutely not.
That's why I give her a heart condition. So she might die soon.
Oh. I had her when I was an au pair and had to leave. I had a Lady Catherine de Bourgh type figure.
Oh, Lord.
One day she's going to go in a book. So she definitely wasn't a lady, but, you know, she was a scary woman.
Yes.
Now, we've got a very interesting question here from Jean. I've heard the view that it's significant that Elizabeth only agrees to marry Darcy after she's seen Pemberley. Do you agree?
No, I've heard this lots of times before. It's a common trope that it looks like she thought, oh, actually, he's quite rich. Now, she knows all this already.
She makes that comment herself, doesn't she?
She does. She uses humour to deflect uncomfortable feelings, as I do myself, and irony, and she's great at it. So when she says it, it's half joking. You have to remember the context of when she says it. You know, she's speaking to her sister and breaking the news that she's marrying this man that everyone thinks she hates. But she knows everything about him. You know, of course she does. She knows how much money he's got. She knows he's got an estate. She knows he lives in London too. She knows all this. And I think what she's really saying is, you know, this whole idea of what the estate stood for. So at this time, this period in history in England, if a man managed his estate correctly, if he had taste and compassion and charity and was good to his tenants, that was a sign, you know, it told you that this was good husband material. A chap who was like that was going to be a good husband and father, wasn't going to run off and give you VD or whatever they called it back then, you know, by the French disease, by running off with ladies of the night. So I think she sees Pemberley, and it's contrasted with Rosings several times in the novels. It's not modern and vulgar. It's not on rising ground. It's been there a long, long time. And so has he. His family have lived there for a long time. And I think it's more about she sees the estate shining a light on his personality, I would say.
Yeah, and we're getting that endorsement from his housekeeper and his sister.
Yes.
I mean, that's two women giving you an endorsement of, you know, somebody being kind to them as a woman of that time. That's surely got to be a great incentive to think, oh, I'm completely wrong about who I thought this person was.
Because when Mrs. Reynolds says, you know, I've known him since he was four and I've never had a cross word from him. Well, if you haven't ever even had a cross word from a four-year-old, then you're doing pretty well. He must be a very nice man.
Let alone a 14-year-old.
Yeah, quite.
Right. So you're going to do your kind of follow up to A Great Deal of Ingenuity. So you're not tempted to do them all in the order in which they were published?
No, I'm not. I just want to do the ones that I feel I want to write. So this is the one I wanted to write first. And now I'm doing the follow up. I just can't wait. I'm so excited about it. I can't wait. I can't write it at the moment because I'm engaged in writing another book. But once that's done and sent off probably about January, February time, I'm going to start on that. And then Emma was just the natural next one because it's so different and it's easy to find the nine people. And also because I am such a massive 19th century nerd, I know all about really, you know, stuff like Queen Victoria's Jean, Porphyria. You know, I'm a bit of an expert on the Victorian time. And I love the fact that it's full of people who are rising socially in Regency times. And by the time the Victorian era is over, their children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren will have titles and be very respectable. And no one will care that their money came from trade. I like that whole social mobility story. But I will work through. I mean, I also just adore Persuasion. I think probably my second favourite. And that will be wonderful to write.
I can't wait for you to write that one because that is my absolute favourite. As you've done with Pride and Prejudice, I reread it whenever I need comfort reading.
Yes, and same.
Just love it. So
it's magnificent.
Let's get you back on when you've done that one. So we've got a question here saying, what is your writing timetable like, please?
That would be three numbers, 24/7, I would say. I'm a full-time writer now. I'm also a freelance writer. So my days are a mixture of juggling freelance work and trying to chug through whichever book I'm currently engaged on. And then I do a lot of events where I go face-to-face with people, which is lovely, and sell my books. I do a lot of talks. I go into schools. I was doing a WI talk recently. How do I sleep? Greta, these are great questions. Not enough, clearly. Behind these glasses, big old bags. I don't. I'm never off. I'm never, ever off. I'm, you know, because I think because this didn't happen for me until I was 54. You know, I wasn't a young thing when I got my first publishing deal. And this is all I've ever wanted, truly. And I never got it. I never thought I would. And when it fell into my lap in lockdown, you know, it was a miracle to me. You know, now 3 years on, I just want to do the very best I can and seize every opportunity. Yes, absolutely, Geeta, great advice here. We need to talk. I know I have burnt out before in the past, but now I'm not working in the city anymore. The children are older. My husband does all the cooking. I've got my own writing studio. I'm doing what I want to do. And I do take time off when I need to, you know. But at the moment, it's pretty much all the time.
But it's making you happy, which is perhaps the key.
Yeah. That's right.
So let's move away from Jane Austen for a little while. Tell us about Isabella M. Smooge.
Oh, yes.
Pronounced as in Bruges.
As in Bruges. There she is. I'm very fond of Izzy. So her name spells out I am smug. That's the joke. That's why she's called Isabella M. Smooge. So she came about because in lockdown, most of my freelance work disappeared, as you would expect. And I found myself with time on my hands, not a problem I currently have and not a problem I ever had in the past. So I, fortunately for me, was writing at the time for a national blog, a writer's blog. And we got to April. I hadn't started that long. It was giving me a chance to write what I wanted to write rather than writing freelance, which is a very different discipline. So again, I remember exactly where I was. April 2020, I was sitting in my dining room and I had three children, still do. And they were all, I suppose, primary and high school, and they were all upstairs. And I can honestly tell you, hand on heart, they were not doing their online homework. And they were piles of clothes everywhere folded that hadn't yet been put away. There was dust. My roots were showing through, as they are today, ladies and gents. There were thistles and weeds in my garden, cobwebs, you know. So it was your standard kind of chaotic sort of setup, you know. And I was looking around at this mess. And back then I did all my writing in the dining room. I was tapping away at something. I thought, what should I write this month? And I remember I started laughing to myself and thinking, gosh, do you know what? I just feel like writing something funny to make all the other writers laugh, because I was always known as the funny one for a number of reasons and humorous. And I thought, right, I'm going to make up a woman who is exactly the opposite of me. So rich, posh, skinny, enormously successful. Her children would always do what they were told. So I thought, right, well, she's got to spell out I am smug. That was my joke, because I do love a pun, Mrs. Smug. So that's how it came out. So I'm scribbling this all down on the back of an envelope. And I thought, I, Isabella, that's a posh name. I mean, smug. I thought, Mrs. Smug, that's not right. And I don't know where the extra GE came from. But as soon as I said it, smooge as in Bruges, I thought, yes. So I wrote this piece called The Utter Joy of One's Craft. You know, dreadfully annoying. One of these terrible internet sirens. Thank you. I could see Pauline laughing. Good stuff, Pauline. I've got you. Wonderful. And it started off, oh, I'm so blessed to live in my beautiful Georgian house with my lovely garden and my three children who play the lute. I had one of them playing the lute and chess. And, oh, I'm so successful. Oh, my agent's on the phone again. Oh, blah, blah, blah. Three paragraphs of this, which I had the most fun writing. It was ludicrous, but almost believable. So she brags for three paragraphs about her writing career and her writing studio and her agent and her publisher being desperate for a reprint because she sells out all the time. So I laughed myself silly writing this. And then I said that I would revert it to Ruth's voice. And I was like, well, obviously not my life, you know, because these people always seem to divide their time. She divides her time between Tuscany and a yacht in Saint-Tropez. And I said, I divide my time between the kitchen and the A12. You know, that's it. That's my life. So all the other writers came on board, because as a blogger, all you want is for other people to say stuff and read it. And they were all saying, this is hilarious. Oh, my goodness. One person got the wrong end of the stick and said she thought I was Isabella M. Smooge and she didn't like me very much. I was like, no, I'm not her. Honest guff. Yeah, Mrs. Bouquet. Yes, good call, Geeta. That's absolutely bang on. Smooge as in Bruges, bouquet, bucket. So I wrote this thing and got loads of comments. So I thought, great, that's great. And then the next month, we are getting to the end of this anecdote, don't worry. The next month, I wrote this terribly serious think piece about how women's mental health was being affected in lockdown. You know, all these women online living their best lives, baking banana bread, finding themselves doing exercise. Dreadfully annoying. You know, shut up. Stop telling me how brilliant your life is. I don't want to know. And I chucked in Isabella at the end. So that was the 7th of May, 2020. And that afternoon, I was in the polytunnel with my husband, not a euphemism. And up came this message, this chap called Tony Collins, who I vaguely thought might be in the group. And he said, Ruth, I think this would make a great novel. Why don't you write me a couple of sample chapters and a story arc, and I'll start pitching it for you. I've just become a literary agent. I was like, I'm sorry, what?
Oh, fantastic.
I fanned myself and smelling salts were brought out and burnt feathers waved under my nose. And my husband said, right, he said, get the kettle on. You're a writer. Go and start writing. I will make you some tea. I kid you not, I sat down at my laptop and out fell two chapters in about 48 hours. And this is not because I am some kind of genius. It's not bad. It's because I'd waited all my life. I've read and read and read and read and read and read, and it's all in here. And it was just ready to come out.
We talk about that a lot on this, that so much of writing is the process of thinking about it and waiting for it to appear. And, you know, people think you have to just sit down and look, but actually so much of it comes when you're out walking, doing other things.
Yes.
And it's so important that when you get down to writing it, that you allow it to all come out.
Oh, amen to that. I mean, I talk about this a lot when I go and give talks and when I go and talk at school and do workshops for people. I say, you know, the writer is eavesdropper. At school, I was constantly being told off for staring out of the window and overhearing juicy conversations and not attending. But that's what I need to be a successful writer, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. We've got a question here from Sue. Do you ever go to literature or book festivals like Cheltenham or Hay?
Oh, Sue, I dream of Cheltenham and Hay. Where I am at the moment, I feel like I'm on the edge. You know, I've been working and working and working for 3 years and writing, and I just want something to happen that will put me into the next level. I would simply adore to go to those places. I do talks all the time. I go to lots of events. Certainly, I do go to small book festivals, but as yet, I'm not well known enough for those people to ask me. But if anyone knows anyone at Cheltenham or Hay, drop my name in. Free copy of Isabella to you. Signed. You can sell it on eBay when I get famous.
So you're known now better for knowing, for writing modern comedy, but your real love, as you've said, is the Hanoverian period. About the era that you love?
Again, your questions are so good. I go on lots of podcasts and it's always the same question. These are good.
Thank you.
No, I really mean it. I think it's the richness of it all, you know. I think there's so much. The fact that the Hanoverians, you know, nobody wanted George I to be the king. And George I absolutely didn't want to be the king. He hated England. He didn't speak English. His prime minister, I think it was Walpole, wasn't it? Completely bamboozled him and made a fortune in the process because he couldn't understand a word he was saying. And, you know, so it didn't start well. And if you read through the marriages and what went on with these people, good Lord, you know, if Channel 4 or Big Brother got their hands on it, you know, this is comedy gold and drama gold. Succession, you know, that sort of thing. So I love the fact that there are so many big characters, but also there are so many bit players who pop up again and again. So, for example, you have Leopold of the Belgians, who marries, you know, Charlotte, the unfortunate daughter of George IV, who was conceived, we think, drunkenly in a fireplace. One time he managed to have it away with his wife. I know, this is all true, his first cousin. And of course, you know, she's this, and that's what I'm going to put in my Emma stories. Everyone sees this young, virtuous, pretty girl who's happily married, which she is, living in this beautiful house, Claremont, that she's going to be the next queen. But no, dies in childbirth quite unnecessarily, and everything switches. And then Leopold has to start working on Victoria. And so it goes on. So I think the fact that there's such an enormous amount of stuff going on and these huge personalities, and again, human nature doesn't really change. That's what draws me in, and how that fed into the Victorian era and our family. I just find it utterly fascinating.
And do you find resonances between it sounds like you do, between the Hanoverian era and when you're writing people like Isabella?
Again, what amazing questions. Yeah, I hadn't thought about it, but I suppose I do. Yes, because you have very strong characters. When we first meet Izzy, she doesn't get on at all well with her mother, who is the daughter of the daughter of Viscount, so she's titled. And she's not very nice. But as the books go on, there's a character arc. So you've got this very powerful mother who has a difficult relationship with her older daughter. You have the charming, manipulative husband. You have the two-faced friend. You know, everybody in there, the court around her, if you like, because she is very famous, very successful, very well off. Everyone knows her name. She's the UK's premier mumfluencer. You know, she's got 4 million followers on TikTok. She's a proper star. And people don't always wish her good. And that's certainly true, you know, the Hanoverian. So yes, there are links.
Yeah. Wonderful. Now, we've got questions coming in thick and fast. So have you ever had writer's block?
Yes, just once. It was awful. One and two just fell out, which was excellent. This one, I have a number three, which came out last year, The Continued Times. I had the most horrendous writer's block. It was awful. I've never known anything like it. I just didn't know what to do. I thought, my goodness, my publisher is great. I said, look, I'm going to need some more time. And they were lovely about it. But I just had to come in here every day and try to write. And I thought, you get this awful fear. What if I can never write again? What if it's completely you know, the muse has fled. So that was grim, but I managed to work through it and it hasn't come back. So
did you have a particular technique or was it just that eventually it went away?
Nope. I just kept on going. And then one day some stuff came out. Simple as that.
And do you always type or do you handwrite?
Oh, I always type. Have you seen my handwriting? Yes.
I can't even read my own handwriting.
I can't read mine. The only time I handwrite now is when I sign books, honestly, or scribble something for the children on a school report. No, type everything. Absolutely 100%.
I have to apologise every time I sign a book because if I write a message, nobody knows what it says.
I just put dear whoever, enjoy, Ruth, kiss, heart. Easy enough. It's a big sort of scrawly line. And I think, oh, they're so excited at meeting a real writer that they don't really look at my awful handwriting. And I give them a sweet as well to soften the blow, you know.
I wrote one of my first books I wrote to a friend and I said, thank you for being a fab friend. And she rang me up and said, I don't know you think I'm fat. No, that's what it says.
That's a good one. I like that.
You should have known my handwriting as well. And we've got asked, do you dictate in case you're, for example, driving and have ideas?
I never have, but an awful lot comes to me when I'm driving. I spend a lot of time. I've still got two children at high school, so I do the school run every day. And I live in a very beautiful rural part of the country in Suffolk. So, it's lovely. And I do drive around a lot one way or another. And what I will often find is I'll be driving along, having a conversation in my head between two characters, trying to work out how to drive the narrative along. And for some bonkers reason, even though I'm a middle-aged woman of slightly confused mien, it actually stays in there. And then when it's out, you know, I come home, I've got a big old file full of notes and I just write it down. I just type it in. And no, I have never yet dictated. I used to interview people for my freelance work and dictate, but no, never have.
Tell us a little bit about your freelance journalism. And did you begin your career as a freelance writer or did you do other work beforehand?
Oh, no. I didn't start my career as a freelance writer until 2008. So again, relatively recent. I was heavily pregnant with child number three. I was living in Suffolk. I had two little boys. I was busy. So naturally, I was looking for a new job, me being a type A overachiever. And it's true, I am. Writing was the thing I wanted to get into, but I couldn't see how it would ever happen. And completely randomly, I was at Ipswich Hospital waiting for a scan. And a girl who used to be in my youth group at church, one of my youth, rang me up. She said, Ruth, I don't suppose you're looking for a job, are you? I was like, do you know, funny enough, I am. And she said, well, did you know I worked for a charity? I said, yes. And she said, did you know we had a magazine? I said, no. And the guy who was running the magazine was absolutely overwhelmed with work. And he came around the office with a job description and passed it around and said, look, you know, does anyone know someone who might be able to do a little bit of freelance work from home, come into the office three times a year? And she was reading it thinking, I know this person. Who is it? And I love this. She got to the phrase, must be nice, but pushy. And thought, it's Ruth, clearly. So I got that job and that was pretty much all remote, but I had to go to London three times a year. Well, Essex, near my parents, luckily with a baby, because I'd drop them off. And do that. And that's what started my freelance career. So I've worked for a lot of charities. I currently work for an estate agent, which are lovely people. I mean, they're full of morals. They're not, you know, the standard sort of thing. Writing freelance sort of like they're kind of like lifestyle interview pieces. So you interview someone about their home, you write the story of their house and how they've lived in it, all the history, which is fascinating. I write for a couple of charities. I do lots of critiquing and editing for other people who write. I help people, you know, stuff like that.
And I believe you're also a poet. Is that right?
Well, apparently I am. Now, this is quite a surprise to me. I haven't quite got my head around this. Yes, I recently put together a book of poetry. Who knew? And I'm publishing it this month.
Brilliant.
Yeah,
so I know. When did you discover your poetic muse?
Well, that's a funny thing. When I was a child living in the village in Essex, I was such a poet, as I say in the foreword. You know, English was the only thing I was any good at. And we lived in Epping Forest. So I was surrounded by rabbits and squirrels and trees and leaves. Yeah, we were all experts on trees living in the forest. And I used to write this free form poetry. And the teachers used to come around and go, give me gold stars and say, wow, this is great. And I was it never rhymed. It was not bad for a child of that age. Then I passed 11 plus, went to grammar school and my life became frightful. Everything went downhill from there and it wasn't good. So I did lots of other things, had a career, never thought about poetry, but read it all the time. I just adore poetry. I love it. And then I started having counselling about 8 years ago because, you know, you get to that age, don't you, where you think, you know, I'm a bit tired of feeling unhappy all the time. So I started doing that. And to my amazement, out fell. And again, I keep using this phrase, and it's not because I'm some prolific genius. I think it was ready to come out. The feelings I was feeling, anger, sadness, bereavement, loss, all those things we do feel if we we shine light on our lives truly, translated as poetry. It's like Wordsworth says, you know, poetry, what is it? It's emotion recollected in tranquility. And all these poems were coming out. And very sadly, in 2014, a very dear friend of mine died young of cancer. And this was the first time, I think, really, that I experienced that heartbreaking loss. And I was heartbroken. Whoa. And I wrote this poem about it after about 3 years. And my husband was in the dining room, back in the dining room again. And he was in a very good mood. He was all happy and jolly and he was toodling about. And I said, oh, I've written this poem. Do you want to have a look? And he said, oh, yeah, lovely. And he sat down and read it. And he's not a crier. And he just sat there sobbing, saying, oh, my goodness, I'm so sad. And I was like, are you? Excellent. He went, what do you mean? And I said, well, yeah, because I am quite... Don't mean it rudely, but when someone cries because they've read your words, you're like, blimey. So I wrote quite a lot of these things. And then every so often another one would come out. And some of them were funny, but most of them were quite cross. And I just had a file on my computer that said poems, you know, and I sort of carried on chugging away every so often. And then what happened was, and this is quite bizarre, recently, for about the last 6 months, I'm still writing, but I work 2 days a week in a bar and restaurant run by a dear friend of mine. I'm the front of house manager, something I used to do back in the day. It gets me away from the screen. I need a bit of headspace away.
Great idea as well for getting ideas.
And it also pays, which is always lovely.
Yes. As a writer, that's always good.
Always helpful to get some money in. And she does this thing called scripted development. So on the last Thursday of the month, we have this event where this lovely chap comes in from Ipswich and he curates this very lovely, safe space where anyone can come in and read a blog, a poem, talk. And it has become this beautiful event. You know, when you just have something in your life, you just think, oh, I want this to last forever. Anyway, I was standing behind the bar giving you all the chat and everything. And I thought, you know what? I've got all these poems. Why don't I read one out? So I did. And blow me down, everyone started crying. I was like, what's the matter? The girl was so sad. I was like, is it? And then I read another one and this woman's going, oh, you're giving me goosebumps, you're giving me goosebumps. So every month I would read another selection and some from Ingenuity and people would cry or laugh or have goosebumps. And it was clearly affecting them powerfully. And I suppose it was such a mixture of people. There were young guys, you know, in their late teens saying that really meant something to me. There were older women, there were older men. It was just such a... So I thought, you know what? I'll have a look at them. Shall I make a book? And I have. There you go.
And we've been asked, are you the next Pam Ayres? But it sounds actually like you're much more serious. Your poems are... I love Pam Ayres. That's all a denigration of Pam Ayres. But it sounds like your poems can actually be very, very sad when you're known for writing comedy.
Yes, they are. Because although I'm known for my funny novels, as I always say when I'm giving talks, you know, you can't just make gags nonstop. That would make you a stand-up comedian. You have to interweave it with sadness. You know, yes, there's lots of jokes, but there's also a lot of heart because underneath all that glitter and perfection, my heroine is a sad little girl who wants to be loved. So I would love to be the next Pam Ayres because I think she's a genius. She really is. And I don't know if I'll be known for my poetry. I've no idea. I mean, I don't know.
And who are the poets that inspire you? Who are the ones that you read again and again?
Oh, yes. Well, modern poets. I absolutely love Wendy Cope. I will read anything that woman writes. She's amazing.
Fantastic. I agree.
Yeah, she's so good. Carol Ann Duffy, obviously. Yeah. Simon Armitage, Brian Bilston. I've got stacks in behind me. I just delivered a poetry workshop a couple of weeks ago and quoted from them and they went down well. When I did my degree at Birkbeck, we did a lot of Browning and I actually love Browning. He's a surprisingly modern poet. I don't mind the romantics. Who else? Gosh, I don't know really. I just read a lot of poems.
That's quite a few,
isn't it? Yeah.
Well, we've got calls for you to do a YouTube channel and put your poems out there. So good luck with the poetry book. I think it's wonderful. When does it come out and what's it called?
It's called The Little Book of Unexpected Poetry because I didn't expect to do it, really. Some of it's funny.
Great title.
Yeah, well, you know. And that should be out, I think, at the end of the month. We're just finalising the book cover and getting it formatted at the moment. So if people, I'm sure you're going to say all this, but if people want to follow me on the social media channels and go to my website, ruthleewrites.co.uk, you will find everything there. And they can also go on my subscribers list. And I'll send out newsletters.
And do you want to tell us about Resolute Books as well?
Mm. Okay, so Resolute Books came about because two ladies of my acquaintance, both writers, both traditionally published, one particularly is quite a famous historical novelist, were very tired of the way they were being treated by their publisher. Now, this is not everyone's experience of traditional publishing, let me say straight away. And they said, what would it look like, actually, if authors set up a small press and decided to do it their way. And they invited me to join. It's by invitation only. And I thought, gosh. And at the time, I had half of Ingenuity written and I had no idea how I was going to publish it. You know, I didn't have the knowledge or the guts really to go for traditional publishing. I didn't want to self-publish. I thought, what do I do? So I was invited to join and more of us have joined. There are now 13 of us. It's a small press. We've got our own logo. And the tagline is "For the Joy of Reading." So each time one of us brings out a book, it has to be of the very highest quality. And we write in a huge number of genres. So it must have, well, as you can see, it must have an excellent cover. I went freelance and used the guy who did my Isabella covers. Really must look beautiful. It must be properly formatted. You'll see the Resolute Press logo there. It must look proper. You know, often I read a book and it's just huge chunks of prose. This is easy to read. You have to have 3 peer reviews before your book is approved. So it's not, you know, it's not just anything will come out. It's a very carefully curated small press and we all support each other.
And for anyone who wants to look it up, it is resolutebooks.co.uk. And just to repeat, Ruth's website, www.ruthleewrites.co.uk. And Lee, by the way, is spelled L-E-I-G-H.
Indeed.
In case you are just a bit like smooge and smug, isn't it?
Yeah, a bit like smooge, yes.
And there's a question here. Is Resolute Books just for women?
No, we're about 50-50 men and women.
And we've already got someone who's just signed up for your news and updates already.
Oh, thank you, Rebecca. I love you.
I do. So going back to Jane Austen, why do you think it is that Jane Austen continues to have such appeal? I mean, she was not that well known in her own time or even shortly after her own death. She's really something people always ask me, did Dickens read Jane Austen? And well, no, people just weren't really reading Jane Austen.
The Victorians weren't Austen fans.
Yeah.
They just weren't.
What was it that first brought her to public interest? And why do you think we still love her today?
I think, okay, so I'm going to answer that with another, something that doesn't sound like it is the answer, but it is. Almost overnight, when the Georgian period ended, almost overnight, everyone stopped building balconies, stopped going out on the street for street walks, put up huge, thick, heavy curtains, and it all changed in Victorian times. You know, it's a joke in Orlando that that's what happens, but it kind of did. And well, I think they saw her as too frivolous. Victorians were quite serious people. They were engaged in building an empire. And while people still read her, and there is lots of anecdotal evidence that people did, I don't think it was until probably the early 20th century, with much more the emancipation of women, the vote, you know, books were more readily available. People weren't in service, you know, society was changing. This is just my view. And I think people rediscovered her, like, oh my goodness, this is amazing. And as to why it is then that she's still so popular, which is kind of not quite the question you asked, but it kind of is, I personally think it's because she was allowed to read whatever she liked in a well-stocked library. And I think nearly every writer who writes prolifically would give you that answer. That's certainly what happened to me. I was given free rein of any book I wanted and I could read anything. And I think that develops a person's mind in a certain way. If you read enough good literature and enough good biography and autobiography and memoir and everything in between, you've got it all in there. You just have to construct it into a readable book. And I think that's what happened to her. She read so widely. She read poetry. William Cowper was her favourite poet. You know, she read incredibly widely and she was encouraged to do so. You know, she was one of 2 girls in a large family of boys, but I don't think anyone ever said you can't do that because you're a girl. And I think that's part of her appeal now. You know, as women, we see her as this incredibly inspiring figurehead for literature. And yet in her time, she was virtually unknown.
Oh, I do hope that in some universe, she is completely aware. What popularity she has today. It's a bit like Van Gogh, really. You think, gosh, this poor man, you know, sold one painting in his entire lifetime to his brother, thought he was a complete failure. And if he could know how much people spend on his paintings now, I do hope that Jane Austen is somehow in the ether somewhere, fully aware of the films and the TV series and, you know, the absolute, you know, fact that everybody associates Mr. Darcy with Colin Firth. You know, he's not going to get away from it. We've got a comment here from Pauline. Her independence of spirit is what makes her books shine, I believe. What do you think?
Beautifully put. And shine is exactly the right word. Quite so. Yes, because she is. You know, she had very few choices in her life. She was an unmarried spinster. You know, she didn't have any money, really. She went where she was told to go. And yet somehow she managed to retain that independence of spirit, which is remarkable when you think what was against her. And there was a lot against her.
Yeah. So if she were alive today, kind of things do you think she'd be doing?
Oh, well, I think she'd definitely be on YouTube. She'd be on the Goldster podcast, undoubtedly, probably your co-host. She'd be doing...
Jane, if you're listening, you can be co-host.
Yeah, come on down. She'd be travelling the country, I think, giving talks. I think she would probably... I'll tell you what she'd be doing. She would have started a programme, a bursary, for young women who don't have much money to write.
Yeah. I think that's a great idea.
Yeah.
What would you do if you could... Obviously, you are doing everything you want to do now, but... Looking into the future, what do you see yourself writing? Are there any things that you've not tackled yet? Any genres that you'd like to do? Anything that you'd like to find out more about?
Another brilliant question. Yes, actually. Somewhere at the very back of my mind, and this is how books work for me, they start round the back here where the comb is taking up my lustrous locks and sort of works its way sort of the forward. I think there's a novel in me, which isn't a funny, easy novel. Which isn't memoir exactly, but kind of is. One of my favourite writers is a woman called Fran Hill, who is also a friend. She brought out an amazing book called Cuckoo in the Nest this year, which is partly based on her own experiences. It's superb. And I've got this teenage girl who's not very happy, who reads all the time, who doesn't know where she's going in life, who thinks she's a failure. She's probably about 14 or 15, living in the 80s. And she's in the back of my mind living there. And I think I'd quite like to write a bittersweet memoir. You know, it's a novel. It would be a novel, but it would be based on some facts. I think that's in there. That would be good to write. And at some point, I mean, if I end up on the Cheltenham and Hay Festival and the BBC do serialise me, come on, folks, why are you waiting? Just do it. And I become enormously famous. I would love, I suppose, to write my memoir. I've had an interesting life.
Yeah.
I'm still having it. I'm making it sound like it's over. It ain't. I'm still going.
No, but it sounds like it would be really fascinating. And I've just looked at Fran Hill's book as well. Would you like to see a series or film about Izzy? And if so, which? Would you prefer it to be on TV or as a movie?
Oh, gosh, I would love that. And I'm not sounding, I don't mean to sound braggy when I say this, but I meet my readers all the time. And the two questions they always ask me is, when's it going to be on audiobook and when's it going to be on the telly? And, you know, I'm not really well known yet. I'm working jolly hard, but, you know, who do I know? Fortunately, one of the Resolute authors is well known and used to do a lot of work for the BBC. I'd love it if it was on TV. I think Izzy would work perfectly as a six hourly episode. So a tea time drama, you know, funny, but with heart. And I can see it. Everyone can see it. And I've cast already. I've done the whole cast when I was in lockdown. I cast everybody in my book launch. It's, oh gosh, what's she called? Come on, Ruth. The lady who plays Princess Margaret, Vanessa Kirby in The Crown.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
She'd be the perfect Izzy. Perfect. And I think Aidan Turner for Johnny, her nasty husband.
I think anything with Aidan Turner in it is just a really...
Oh, come on. That's guaranteed to get good ratings. I'd watch that. I think Pauline would from the look on her face. yep.
Emma's made a comment. She said, I agree that your memoir would be very interesting. Definitely should write. Oh, she wants it turned into a film. Who is Aidan Turner? I can't believe we've got that as a question.
Google him immediately, Geeta. Google him immediately. He's a very handsome man. Wasn't he in The Lord of the Rings somewhere?
Oh, I don't know, but I know he was Dante Rossetti in Desperate Romantics.
He's yummy. He's a very handsome chap. Classically good looking, I think we
might say. But he's also a very, very good actor.
Oh, yes, sorry. Yes, of course he's a good actor. Yes, that's the most important part. He just isn't bad to look at either.
We have got so many comments here about why isn't there an audiobook? Can you do the audiobook? And you said that's what you always get asked. So
yes, always. Well, the thing is, I could do it myself. I could go down to Monkey Nut on the South Coast, who are superb, but I would have to find a chunk of cash I don't have if I did it myself. I just don't have that money. However, a lady who is an actor and writer and also runs her own audiobook company did reach out to me about Ingenuity and is interested in possibly doing that. So watch this space, folks. I really hope that comes to something because I would love it. And I've got so many blind and partially sighted readers who have to rely on the software to read my books and they so want it.
It's a really, really important market for precisely that reason.
Yes.
It's the same with doing online events. I hadn't realized until lockdown and as well as working with Goldster, I was doing my own online events and I had so many people email me and say, I've never been able to come to your art gallery tours because I'm housebound or I'm disabled or I'm caring for somebody. I've been following you on Twitter and I see these events and it's so great that you're doing them online. And I felt really humbled that I'd never actually thought about this whole kind of audience out there who cannot get to do a walking tour or who can't read a book because they don't need an audio book or an online event. So I think it's
so important to give them that. Yeah. Yeah, I completely agree. There's a whole tranche of people out there who are desperate to read and they need to be able to do that.
Yeah. Well, would you narrate them yourself or do you feel you'd rather get an actress in?
I wouldn't mind narrating them myself, but I don't really know how it works. If a professional company came along, they might ask me to do it, which would be fine, or they might do it themselves. I'm happy either way.
Yeah, brilliant. And before we go on to what's coming up next on Goldster, if you were to move into any of the houses in Pride and Prejudice, which one would it be and why?
Oh, gosh, that's such a good one. And can I just say, folks, she didn't ask me any of these questions before. I had no idea she'd ask me that.
Well, you want me to tell them what's coming up with on Goldster and then we'll come back and you can tell us.
No, it's all right. I know. I'm going to go for Longbourn because I don't want to live in a massive, huge mansion with loads of servants. I like the look of Longbourn. I like the pretty little wilderness, you know, and the windows facing full west. For me, that would be fantastic, you know, going up from a semi-detached, drafty Victorian cottage to Longbourn. I'll go there, please.
I think for most of us, Longbourn really would be a step up. Yeah, I totally agree with that. So I'm just going to tell everybody, if you could just bear with us for a couple of minutes there, Ruth, tell everybody what is coming up next on Goldster. Now, first of all, I need to say that the book of the month this month, in case you're not already reading it, Joanna Quinn's The Whalebone Theatre, beautifully written. If you haven't started reading it yet, do. That's really lovely. That is, as always, on the last Friday of the month. I'm doing it this month, and that is the last Friday is the 27th of October. So please do get reading The Whalebone Theatre by Joanna Quinn. It is out in paperback now. And then next week, I'm back with you on Thursday. I'm going to be interviewing the thriller writer, Adrian Magson, but I'm also going to be talking to him about the fact that he's written hundreds of short stories. And I find that really fascinating because it's such a different craft. So we're going to talk about his novels and his short stories. And then Humphrey is back on Friday and he will be coming to you from Singapore because he's going over to Singapore for work and he will be tuning into Goldster. By the way, if there's any problems with his flights or anything, don't worry, I'm on standby. So we will definitely have one of us interviewing thriller writer Kevin DeClaver, who's also a psychiatrist in Texas. He currently holds the Mackenzie Foundation Chair in Psychiatry at the University of Texas. And when he's not working or practicing martial arts, he writes fiction. He's not someone I'm keen to get on the wrong side of. I'm just telling you that. So if I end up taking over, I'm going to be very, very aware and watch my P's and Q's. And then the following week, we don't have a thriller writer. We just so happen that we've got two next week. I am going to be interviewing Francesca Wade. She's a young woman who's got her debut book out. It's called Square Haunting, which is from a quotation by Virginia Woolf. And it's a really fascinating book. It's beautifully written. Again, it's about Mecklenburg Square in London and the five extraordinary women who lived in that between the wars, in that one square. Not all at the same time, but they all lived at an address on that square between the wars. And they included Virginia Woolf and Dorothy L. Sayers. And she's going to talk to us about all those. A really, really fascinating book. As I say, she's a young woman with a debut book out. And then, of course, the book of the month is, as I mentioned, The Whalebone Theatre by Joanna Quinn. Now, just to go take us into November, 2nd of November, I'm interviewing Wendy Moore. She is the author of Endell Street, The Women Who Ran Britain's Trailblazing Military Hospital. It's been featured on BBC Radio 4 as Book of the Week, and it's the story of two pioneering female doctors, Louisa Garrett Anderson and Flora Murray. They set up and ran a major military hospital in London during the First World War. Such an interesting story. And then, for those of you who are Elvis fans, have we got any Elvis fans in the house? I'm sure that we have. We have got a new book by, we've got raised hands going up already, Inside Story with Shelley Powers. Now, Shelley is a British woman, but she lived in Las Vegas for many years. When she was 7 years old, she told her mum she was going to marry Elvis Presley when she grew up. Well, she didn't do that, but she did marry an Elvis impersonator. And through being married to him and living in Vegas, she became hugely involved with Elvis International, also known as the Memphis Mafia. The people that she interviewed were Elvis's friends and associates. Now, she hasn't ever published these interviews before, and she's just published a book called Elvis Remembered, and it's already causing a huge amount of excitement in the US. So she is going to come onto Goldster on the 3rd of November. So tell your friends and don't miss that. Just to also let you know that I'm quite excited about a later thing in November. And I'm going to tell you about this because it's another live Goldster event. And you can apply for tickets. It's going to be in London. So I am aware that that does cut a lot of people out. But of course, it's always online as well. So don't worry, you're not going to miss this. This is Bonnie Greer, who I met briefly the other night, who was lovely because, yeah, I saw that Ruth made an ooh face. I've been pretty terrified about this.
Impressive.
But I'm so excited about meeting Bonnie Greer. She is going to be in London with us live on Goldster on Thursday, the 16th of November. So if you would like to attend, Goldster members, please do email the concierge at Goldster and get your name on that very special guest list. And if you can't get down to London or you can't come that particular day, don't forget, of course, that you can watch it online as you're doing right now. And you can watch it on Catch Up, as with all of ours. And of course, you can listen to the Goldster podcast. So thank you very much for bearing with us, Ruth. So we've got quite a few questions here that I'm trying to see. You know how the characters are, and they spoke as if they were in your head. So you'll need to prep the narrator for your audiobook if you don't want to change the character styles. That is some advice here. I think that's actually a really good idea because I have listened to books where the narrator suddenly changes and they don't always get who the characters were. You know, memorably don't necessarily realize that they've got a particular accent or how to pronounce their name. So that is a very, very good tip. And, oh, we've got a question here for you. What is your favorite Elvis song? Do you have a favorite Elvis song?
I do. I would say it would probably be, Hound Dog.
Hound Dog. Okay. Yeah. I think mine is In the Ghetto. It's just makes me cry all the time.
Yes, though. That's true.
But it's absolutely lovely. And I just think it's a real protest song.
Or a little less conversation. That'd be my second favourite.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, well, absolutely, you're going to have to come along, everybody, and find out with Shelley Powers on the 3rd of November. Well, I'm really, really thrilled that you came to us today, Ruth. It's been absolutely brilliant. And we've had a question again. Could I put in the chat the name of the book of the month? So I'm trying to put it in the chat here now. But it is The Whalebone Theatre by Joanna Quinn, just in case you didn't all hear it. There it is. It's in the chat. Ruth, good luck with everything that you're writing.
Thank you so much.
Please do come back on and talk to us when your next book comes out. And good luck with the poetry. We will look forward to hearing
so much. Thank you so much, everyone. It's been lovely to see you all. Thank
Have
you.
A great weekend, and I will see you next week, and so will Humphrey. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this Goldster podcast, where we aim to bring you great interviews to expand your world and to keep you curious. Please look us up at www.goldster.co.uk. That's Goldster spelt G-O-L-D-S-T-E-R. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast.